Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show today. And we have some interesting guests lined up for us this hour, reminding you all that it is fundraising time here at WEAA, and to encourage all of you to call 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to pledge your support for programming that you can get nowhere else. Or call toll-free at 1-866-770-3982. Or just log on to WEA.org and pledge online. If you pledge to 88.9 and make a pledge of $88 or more, we're going to send you a copy of Great American Hypocrites by my guest, Glenn Greenwald. It's an incredibly interesting book, fitting for this moment of this election. And whoever you vote for, vote right now for WEAA at 410-319-8888. Show your support for the Mark Steiner Show and WEAA. And Glenn Greenwald, welcome. Good to have you with us. All right. We got Glenn there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you. Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
And welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Glenn's a contributing writer at Salon.com, and you can just log on there right now and see some of the really interesting pieces he's written. He's the author of books like Tragic Legacy and How Would a Patriot Act? And the book we're talking about today and his blogs is Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Big Myths of Republican Politics. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. I was rereading your book last night, kind of in the blogs and looking at the news. And well, before I jump into today's news in terms of what you've written, I have to say I just love the way the book starts with John Wayne. I never thought of John Wayne and the creating of the mythology of John Wayne as being a precursor to how we see right-wing Republican politics work in America.
Right. Well, I, the reason I find him so symbolic, and he actually is genuinely the pioneer of the right-wing template. I mean, they've modeled their candidates and their attempt to depict themselves as these sort of traditionally courageous, masculine men of patriotism and traditional values after the John Wayne iconography. And the reason that I think he's such an illustrative example of what the right wing has become is because during World War II, unlike now when most American males, the vast majority, do not fight in our wars, only a tiny portion of the population mm-hmm. does. Back in World War II, American males were lined up literally around the block in order to volunteer to fight in that war, and that included virtually the entire top echelon of Hollywood movie stars.
That's right.
People like Henry Fonda and Tyrone Power, Clark Gable. Lots of actors, very successful actors, who could easily have gotten out of fighting because of their age or their family obligations or other things. Nonetheless, volunteered. John Wayne was really the only big Hollywood star who was eligible to fight, who not only didn't, but desperately avoided the draft for the entire war and stayed in Hollywood and took advantage of the fact that he was the only actor of any note who wasn't fighting and pretended to be a war hero by playing, you know, war heroes in films and got very rich doing so. And then having evaded the draft the entire war, spent the next, you know, 40 years of his life cheering on every American war and accusing any war opponent of being a coward or a communist or a traitor, things like that. And so this sort of faux patriotism and masculinity and warmongering was in stark contrast to what he in his actual life was willing to do and is representative of the right wing in that sense, and similarly his advocacy of traditional values and very aggressive criticism of those he deviated stood in stark contrast to his personal life. You know, he had a whole string of adulterous affairs and broken families and addiction to alcohol and drugs, and obviously, you know, there are all sorts of leaders of the right wing who are quite similar in that regard as well.
Well, what's interesting to me is people often criticize the establishment press, as at least from the left side of the spectrum, and many liberals as having been bought out by corporate America, so it's slanted. But and the right wing says, of course, it's a liberal press that's bought out by the left. But what you have is kind of a nuanced position about this in your book, in which you write that not so much that the establishment media is bought out, but it buys into the distortions of the right-wing blogs and Fox News. And the question is, why? I mean, how does that happen? Why do you think it happened?
Well, that's, you know, I think it's hard to give a very concise answer to why. But certainly, you know, I think the fact that most of these media outlets are owned by the largest corporations and most powerful corporations of the country makes the idea that, you know, they're out there proselytizing a leftist agenda when their corporate parents, you know, profit greatly from conservative and especially militaristic policies, I think is absurd. But what it really does is it creates a culture within these corporations. You know, most corporate cultures are very pro-establishment and not about undermining power. They're about serving power. That's the typical corporate climate. And most of these reporters work in a very corporate climate these days because our press is so corporatized. And they really become reliant upon, dependent upon, serving and pleasing powerful political officials. That's how they get their access. That's how they get their scoops. That's how they're able to remain popular with those in power. And over the last 15 to 20 years, political power in this country has meant Republican power. And so there's a lot of currying favor with the Republican establishment that has led them to develop all sorts of friendships and relationships and alliances, even marriages and family relationships, so that the Republican power structure in Washington and the establishment press has merged in a lot of ways. And then on top of that, you know, there are ideological aspects to the fact that the press really kind of revered George Bush as a person, and they hated Al Gore and John Kerry. They formed an alliance with the right during the 90s when it was the right and the media jointly feeding the sex scandals and the Clinton witch hunt. And so there's a lot of reasons why, but clearly, culturally and in terms of the mores of modern journalism, there's a very close relationship between the Republican Party and the media.
Join us here at 410-319-8888 to join this conversation with Glenn Greenwald, as well as make your pledge at the same time. His book we're talking about is now in paperback, Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Big Myths of Republican Politics. He is a contributing writer to Salon. Log on there right now to see some of the things that he's been writing as we talk. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And make your pledge, same time, 410-319-8888, as we talk with Glenn Greenwald about his latest work and his latest blogs. I really found your blogs today really fascinating in terms of just in terms of your thesis in your book, but also what you've been writing here. That the piece you wrote called "Mark Halpern Defends Rush Limbaugh's Powell Race Theory." I found that fascinating because you hit the nail on the head later in your blog. How people are accusing Powell of endorsing Obama because of race. But what about all the other conservative pundits who have come out and said we can't support McCain and supporting Obama?
Yeah, you know, I found that whole episode where, you know, Colin Powell went on Meet the Press and articulated a lot of really well-thought-out reasons for why he is endorsing Obama, which, as you suggest, many other conservatives have also voiced. The number of Republicans and right-wing figures and especially conservative newspapers, editorial pages, that are endorsing Obama after, you know, decades endorsing only Republicans is really quite striking. And nobody accused them of being motivated by race because, you know, most of them are white, and in the cases of the newspapers, overwhelmingly white in terms of their editorialists. And yet suddenly, you know, Colin Powell, whom the right has always held up as this sort of proof that they on the right are colorblind, comes out and for many of the same reasons that lots of other people have been articulating, says he's endorsing Obama. And immediately, you know, people like Rush Limbaugh and Pat Buchanan and Matt Drudge immediately start insisting that the only reason Powell did that was because he's black and Obama's black, you know, that it was a matter of race loyalty more than a good faith assessment of who he thought should be president. It was really quite an ugly and really overtly racist reaction. And as you said, what I found amazing about that wasn't that just people on the right are doing that, but establishment journalists are starting to embrace that theory as well, so that you had Time Magazine's Mark Halpern, you know, one of the most sort of insider journalists, going on right-wing talk radio today and basically saying that he thought Rush Limbaugh was right. I mean, he dialed it back a little bit and said he thought race was a factor, not the only one, but still said that he thought that was part of what motivated Powell. And the other thing that you have is, you know, you have someone like Joe Lieberman, who has been a Democrat his whole life and has never endorsed any conservative candidate before, who's been spending the whole year campaigning for John McCain and now Sarah Palin, and nobody suggested, at least that I heard, that he was motivated by race, that he wanted to endorse the white candidate, not the black candidate. But the theory is the same, and yet, you know, people pinned that claim on Powell, but not on people like Joe Lieberman. I found that striking.
You also wrote about Joe Lieberman and the Democratic leadership in the Senate being almost afraid to take Joe Lieberman on, to say, here's a man who has gone out to label Barack Obama a terrorist, to almost call him a socialist, to as a demeaning way, and to kind of really push that weight around with traveling with Palin, yet the Democratic leadership in the Senate, Reid and others, are afraid to say, well, we're going to take away his senior position as a Democrat.
Right, and I think it's pretty illustrative of how the Democratic leadership in Congress behaves. I mean, in general, you know, there's a very strong cultural current in Congress where incumbents protect one another no matter what. You know, Joe Lieberman has been undermining and undercutting Democrats for years. I mean, he, you know, not only was a supporter of the war, but was saying things like, you know, Democrats are criticizing the commander-in-chief in a time of war at their own peril, you know, suggesting that his own party were treasonous in essence for criticizing the president instead of blindly supporting him during a time of war. And yet most of those Democratic leaders in the Congress, when Lieberman was challenged by an actual war opponent in 2006 in Altamont in Connecticut, you know, flocked to support Joe Lieberman, even though he, at every chance he got, was propping up the president and undermining his own party. And now it's even worse. He's spent the whole year running around the country. You know, he's gone to South Florida many times to try and scare Jewish voters into believing that the party's nominee is, you know, hostile to Israel and even anti-Semitic. He went on Fox News and said, I think it's a good question to ask whether Obama if he's a Marxist. You know, implying that he's a radical, that the Democrats can't protect the country. Somebody who is engaged in the most extremist, McCarthyite, slimy attacks on the Democratic Party. If you're not willing to expel someone like that from your own party and are willing to, you know, allow him to continue to wield power as a committee chairman, it just basically tells the country that you don't stand for anything and that you're not willing to even stand up for yourselves.
Glenn Greenwald is our guest. Great American Hypocrites, the book we're talking about, and his work as a contributing writer to Salon.com, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts about right-wing talk radio and Fox News and how it affects establishment news, how it affects what people think and hear in America, how it affects this election. What do you think at 410-319-8888? The talk line and the pledge line. So join us here. And Glenn, I wonder about that. I wonder if we're seeing a sea change, though, at this moment between American media and politics, that the kind of lies and distortions kind of maybe put out by some people in the Republican Party around Obama's campaign. I wonder if that's no longer being bought hook, line, and sinker, as that in terms of a diminishing, as indication of a diminishing power of right-wing talk radio and right-wing TV in general, media in general.
I think that's a good point. You know, one of the interesting things is that I wrote this book at the beginning of this year, and I had analyzed the tactics that Republicans use in the past to win elections, and what it always has in common is that they want to distract attention away from substantive positions.
Right.
Where most Americans disagree with them and focus on these kind of personality smears where they, you know, depict the Democratic candidate as this sort of elitist, subversive, exotic, effete, even kind of gender-confused freak and build a cult of personality around their Republican candidate. Clearly, that's what they've been attempting to do this year because they know and they've said that if the election is decided based on issues, they're going to lose. And yet it's interesting, I think you're right, that those tactics have been far less effective this year than they ever have been in the past, and I think in part because the country feels that the problems that the country faces are so serious that those kind of petty, you know, culturally tribalistic distractions aren't interesting to people. They're not being blinded by that. And I think that Democrats have, or at least the Obama campaign, has learned how to handle that. They fought back very aggressively and engaged it offensively many, many times and rendered it much, much less powerful. And I think you're right. What you're seeing is the collapse of right-wing power, and therefore their ability to really dominate our media outlets as well.
I mean, it seems as if what's happening, though, is when I listen to Governor Palin's speeches and listening to Senator McCain and others who are fighting for their candidacy, that they're using all the arguments that come straight out of Fox, straight out of Rush Limbaugh, straight out of that kind of right-wing bashing talk media. But it's maybe solidifying their base, but the rest of the country is just turning away. And I think maybe part of it is what you're describing here, and part of it may also be Obama himself. That seems that there's some kind of shift going on in America now, and I'm not quite sure how to put my hands around it.
Yeah, I think there's clearly a shift. I mean, if you think about it, you know, sometimes pundits will say things like, isn't it amazing that Obama is only leading by a few points in the polls, given that the climate is so favorable to Democrats? And I actually look at it as the exact opposite. I mean, if you think about it, it's actually extraordinary. That this sort of, you know, skinny African-American politician from Chicago who's fairly unknown and new on the scene, mm-hmm. And is perceived as a liberal and has the name Barack Hussein Obama with half his family descending from Kenya quite recently and having grown up in Indonesia for part of his childhood, et cetera, is leading in the polls with 3 weeks to go fairly substantially over, you know, a white conservative Republican war hero. That is extraordinary. And I think that it does represent a sea change in lots of different ways. The country's changing demographically. There are a lot more voters who, for whom those kind of tribalistic appeals don't really resonate. There's lots and lots of new voters who have been brought into the process as a result of excitement over Obama. I think that the country has really turned against, in a very vehement way, the Iraq War and the central ideology of the Republican Party, so that doing things like, you know, accusing Obama of wanting to wave the white flag of surrender, as Sarah Palin did in her debate, you know, not only doesn't resonate, it's actually going to backfire, given that the vast majority of the country sees the Iraq War just the same way that Obama does. And so I think the Republican Party has really gone to the well a few too many times with those demonizing tactics, and it just rings kind of sad and pathetic and obsolete, and I think you see that the effects of that now.
I'm going to take a call in here before we take a break to tell you about WEAA at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Glenn Greenwald. His book, Great American Hypocrites. Jim in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just had a question. I just wanted to get a context. I'm kind of embarrassed that I really am not that politically astute, but a context that gives me a place to look from right and left wing. Like, when people say right and the left wing, like, what do they really mean when they're saying that? Like, what's the context of that? That's really my question. I just turned it and I just wanted
What are the what of that aspects you said?
What's the context?
Context of right and left wing.
Yeah.
How would you define that, Glenn?
Well, the origin of it is it comes from the British Parliament, where the Tories and the people who had allegiances to the King sat on the right side of Parliament, and so conservatives have been referred to as being on the right, and liberals or progressives, people who want to change the society, on the left. I think that those labels have lost a lot of their meaning. But at least when I use the term right, I generally refer to the kind of predominant faction within the Republican Party that supported, you know, the radical foreign policy and anti-constitutional abuses of the Bush administration. And, you know, it's people mean different things by the left. But I guess generally that refers to opponents of the Bush administration and some of the more ideologically pure people in the Democratic Party.
Hey Glenn, we're going to take a short break here so we can talk a bit about EAA during our fund drive. So we'll come right back with Glenn Greenwald, and we're going to talk about the media and McCain with him in this election right now, and look at what bloggers will do if Obama wins. What will be their attack then? We'll talk about that and more with Glenn Greenwald. But right now, join us here at 410-319-8888. And Kevin and Sean, we're holding on to talk. We'll get your calls when you come back with Glenn. But while you're holding on, make a pledge. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. My guest for this part of our program is Glenn Greenwald, who is the author of Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Myths of Republican Politics. Log on to salon.com now to see his writing as we have a conversation with him. Those of you who called in to join the conversation, call back at 410-319-8888. The lines are full, only be full for a minute, and call right back, make your pledge, and join this conversation. After we talk to Glenn, we're going to be joined by Martina Carrera and Deidre O'Connor talking about the Troy Davis case in Georgia, a man who's about to be executed for a crime he may not have committed. But right now we're talking with Glenn Greenwald, who joined us here. Glenn, again, going back to where we left off, a couple of questions. You write a lot in the last chapter of your book about Senator McCain and how the media is just infatuated with him and has been for some time. Has that changed? Do you see a change in the tenor of that, or are they still there despite themselves?
I think it's changed to some degree. I mean, it couldn't have gotten any worse. I mean, literally the reverence that the dominant media had for John McCain was like no other candidate that I can recall. And most of them readily acknowledge that. And part of it was because he purposely courted the press. He was uniquely accessible. They would spend lots of time riding around with him on his campaign bus and chatting with him. They would do things like go to his ranch in Arizona. They did most of the major media that covered his campaign did that earlier this year and went to his house for a barbecue. And they almost looked at him like one of their good friends, mm-hmm. someone they really looked up to. I think given the kind of campaign that McCain has run, the way in which he kind of hired a lot of the disciples of Karl Rove to run his campaign, it's been a much uglier and nastier campaign than I think they anticipated. A lot of the more traditional screens between the candidate and the media have been put into place so that their access has been cut off. I think has eroded the affection that a lot of them have had for McCain. But even if you listen to them now, as ugly and nasty and dirty as McCain's campaign is, most of them will say, this isn't the real John McCain. This isn't the way that he wants to win. This is not really who he is. And they make excuses for him. But in fairness, you know, I think that the kind of campaign that he's run has alienated a lot of those reporters and caused there to be a bit more balanced coverage than one might have anticipated, say, 6 months ago.
There's hope after all, eh? So I wonder, Glenn, when you think of how the world of the blogosphere has grown over the last years, and a lot of it, especially you are a representative of the portion of that blogosphere that came out in reaction to the distortions in the press, to what happened in the Iraq War, what's going on with Katrina, what happened in this Bush White House. Where do you think that your work and the world of that blogosphere will go now if Obama becomes the president of the United States? Do you think it changes anything?
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen, but my view of what blogs do best is that they serve as an oppositional force, mm-hmm. not only to the mainstream media, not only to the Republican Party, but also to the Democratic leadership, which has been incredibly passive and acquiescent and often actively complicit mm-hmm. in much of the radicalism of the Bush administration. The people who have been running the Democratic Party aren't going anywhere. And if the Democrats win in 3 weeks, as most people expect that they will, certainly they're going to maintain control of the Congress, and their majorities are likely to increase substantially. And if they take over the White House as well, you know, they're going to be a party with more or less absolute control over the government and are going to need lots of checks and restraint. On not only their excesses and corruption, which is substantial, but also on the kind of ideological path they pursue. There's going to be great pressure on them to adopt this sort of centrist, accommodating, even kind of right-wing course. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of articles already from people like Newsweek's editor-in-chief John Meacham this week declaring that this is a center-right country and that the worst thing the Democrats can do is get into office and pursue a progressive agenda. You know, I think there's general temptations that politicians have. I mean, the Bush administration has created this extraordinarily powerful office in the presidency, And it's not human nature to get into office and start making yourself less powerful. So, you know, I think there's going to be a great need for there to be a lot of checks on the Democrats. And my hope and expectation is that bloggers will continue to provide that rather than becoming cheerleaders for the Democratic Party.
I wonder, Glenn, before we let you go, I wonder if you think that on some levels a dynamic will change. I mean, one of the arguments people are making that about an Obama presidency is that there will be room at the table for a much broader conversation. In other words, I was thinking about a conversation, I know Volcker is close to him now, but he's had these conversations around the economy that have ranged in group teleconferences between Stiglitz and Rubin and everything in between. And I wonder if that dynamic in terms of the progressive part of the political spectrum of America, then pushing an Obama administration takes on a different context than it would otherwise.
I think it's a big unknown. I mean, one of Obama's talents absolutely is making lots of different people across the political spectrum feel as though they're being listened to and taken seriously and accommodated. And if you look at even his early support, it really did range from, kind of the left flank of the progressive movement to the kind of transpartisan, more conservative center senators like Claire McCaskill and Jay Rockefeller
right.
and people like that. So he has a great ability, like most good politicians, to make people see in him what they want to see. Who it ends up that actually exerts influence over him, I don't think anyone knows at this point. I think anyone who's hoping that he's going to get into office and be this progressive beacon,
right.
I think is going to be sorely disappointed. He's never held himself out as that. That's not what he is.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah, but at the same time, I think one of his talents is consensus building, and he realizes he needs the left. And, I think it'll certainly be better than it's been the last 8 years. I guess that's the only thing we can know for certain, and everything else we're going to have to wait and see.
Let's try to get one caller in here before we talk about the Troy Davis case, which is what we have to let our listeners know about because it's sorely in need of conversation. But let's go now to Sean. You're on the air.
How you doing? Hey, this might be a little to the right. I just turned the station on, man. And, hey, man, people are really afraid of this guy. Like, what more can be done to this country? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't understand why. Like, my boss just a few minutes ago. Well, I'm scared, if Obama gets in because he's supposed to fire the House of Treasury or something like that. He's supposed to let two people go, and he don't think that's a good decision. Like, people are really just afraid of this man. Pushed kill about 4,000 troops. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, the war was a lie. The war was a lie. I mean, but we don't talk about that no more, I mean, just a flat-out lie, man. It's sad that a lot of troops had to go, but there's nothing that Obama is going to do. And he's worse than what Bush has done, Then he said, you don't have experience. Well, that's why he has Joe Biden. Like, I'm not that, I'm in the politics. I'm not going to lie. I think I got into politics heavy when it was Bush Kerry. I'm a little rusty.
Well, Sean, we have to take a break here in a second, but before we close out in this part of our conversation with Glenn Greenwald, I think that one of the things we're going to find out, Glenn, in November, on November 4th, is how deep the kind of very conservative feelings of America go by what happens in this election.
Right. I mean, I think actually the caller makes, the comment raises an interesting point, which is, I think it's one of the reasons why this whole sort of fear-mongering campaign against Obama isn't working. I mean, how can you scare the country into believing that Obama is a socialist when they see, the Republican president as a result of extreme mismanagement by the Republican Party, literally nationalizing banks in order to prevent economic collapse? And how do you convince the country that they need to be afraid of Obama when literally every aspect, every sphere of our public realm lies in shambles after the last 8 years? And I do think there's a great sense of, well, this can't be worse. if we change. And while people have identified with conservatism over the past, say, 25, 30 years since Ronald Reagan, I think now they're the ruination of the Republican Party is so great that the brand has really been sullied for what very well may be years, if not decades or a generation.
Greenberg, well, thank you so much for taking your time. Look forward to talking to you again, and keep on writing and provoking us. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Thank you so much. Glenn Greenwald was our guest in the first part of our program. We're going to turn now to the Troy Davis case. It's in Georgia now, and it's a really very important case. We may be seeing Georgia send a innocent man to death row, and it is something that we need to make all of us in this community aware of, that the battle around the issue of the death penalty is a very important one. And we did, in fact, contact the prosecutor's office and asked them to join us. They sent a statement instead and declined to be part of this discussion, as I understand it, being declined to be part of many discussions. And at the moment, we are about to introduce you to Martina Correa, who is Troy Davis's sister. She's part of the National Steering. She is his National Steering Committee Chair for Amnesty International's USA's program to abolish the death penalty, and Amnesty International's State Death Penalty Abolitionist Coordinator in Georgia. As I said, the sister of Troy Davis, and Deidre O'Connor is a professor of law at the Emory Law School and director of the Innocence Matters Project. And Martina Correa and Deidre O'Connor, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
All right, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us here at the last minute. Join us here at 410-319-8888 and to join this conversation. I was reading, I spent a long time today for the first time reading Spencer Lawton Jr.'s, the district attorney's for Eastern Judicial Circuit of Georgia's comments about Taseman's response to the denial of a certiorari by the Supreme Court of the United States in Davis versus Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who I should go to. James, let me just go, if I might, go to you first about this is for a legal question here. I mean, they raise a lot of arguments. Well, let me start this way. For a lot of our listeners don't know what's going on here. Take us back to the beginning. Deidre first and Martina to the beginning of this case of what happened to give people an understanding of the lay of the land here. Let me start legally with Deidre O'Connor, then go to Martina Correa to talk a bit about that as well. Deidre?
Well, thank you. First of all, Martina may have some more relevant information about the early days. I've only been connected with this case for the past year. But there was a shooting in Savannah in 1989 that occurred in a dimly lit parking lot late at night and was resulted in the deaths of an officer and an assault of a homeless man. We know that the whole incident started by a person named Sylvester Red Coles hassling a homeless man for his beer. When the man refused to turn over his beer, Red got angry, and Red is, according to witnesses, known to carry a weapon, usually a .38 caliber revolver, got angry and said, "You don't know me, I'll shoot you." Within seconds of that, Young was pistol whipped and Officer McPhail was shot. At trial, there were a number of witnesses that came forward and identified Troy Davis as the shooter, despite the fact that this was a case, if you just follow the logic of it, that seems more plausible to be Red that would have pistol whipped Young and shot Officer McPhail. The issue from my perspective with this particular case is to examine the underlying reliability of the original trial evidence, and I think that's one aspect of the case that hasn't been discussed a great deal in the media, and I'm hoping that this will be an opportunity to do that. In any event, there was a trial. He was convicted in 1991. There was a direct appeal by the same lawyer who tried the case, and there are many who have examined the trial record and find that representation lacking. There was a problem with receiving any representation from 1991 through 1996 because the Resource Center in Georgia had funding issues. They were severely cut. 70% of their funding was slashed. And essentially, Troy was unrepresented until 1996. After that period of time, the attorneys began to work the case and discovered that what in fact seems to be the case, that the evidence received at trial was unreliable. The witnesses recanted their statement. And since that time, the attorneys working on this case have been trying to get a court to look at the evidence, and they've been unsuccessful in having any court examine the evidence thus far.
Are the case Martina Correa? Am I pronouncing your last name right, Martina Correa?
Yes, and I couldn't hear Deirdre, so
I'm sorry.
I won't repeat anything she's saying.
Well, I first want to introduce you again. Martina Correa is the sister of Troy Davis, and she's been fighting for her brother's life for a long time now. She also fought cancer. At the same time, she was fighting for her brother. She has not given up this fight. The Supreme Court turned down his appeal. He's scheduled to be executed next week, if I'm correct. And Martina, talk about this from the beginning, because, I mean, this case was murky from the start. If I understand it right, they never found a weapon. There was no real evidence linking to the crime other than eyewitnesses who have since recanted their testimony. Am I right?
That's correct. Yes, like I said, I hope I'm not repeating Deirdre.
It's okay. If you do, I'll say, oh, let's go somewhere else, but go ahead, please.
Okay. But yes, that night in 1989, there was, you know, the altercation with the homeless man, everything was turned on Troy when Sylvester Coles went to the police department, you know, with his lawyer. And like you said, 7 of the 9 eyewitnesses recanted, but we also have 9 additional witnesses who either have firsthand knowledge of the murder or the gentleman, Sylvester Red Coles, was even talked about in detail about the murder, you know, bragging about it. And so what's amazing to me is that, you know, Troy has, you know, once he was just really crucified in the newspaper. This is the death of a white police officer. It happened near the housing projects and, you know, in a black community. And they were just really, really trying to find out what happened, and they had no clue. And until Sylvester Coles walked into the police station, you know, they had no idea of what was going on. I mean, everything was so distorted. And it seems amazing to me that, you know, from 1991 and 1996, Troy really had no lawyer because the resource centers that defended death row inmates was defunded. Mm. So during a pivotal part of his appeals process, and the first habeas appeal being held in the prison, you know, there's no witnesses or anything called, no money for investigation. And, you know, what's amazing to me is that, you know, the district attorney spends a lot in saying, oh, Troy's had his case reviewed by 27 judges and 7 different this and that.
Right.
But it's only been filing paper, you know, papers, you know, you need to hear this evidence. And someone said, well, you should have brought it up before, you know. And, you know, today, you know, he's talking about adjudication and this and this and that in the paper. It's amazing that he put all that stuff in that statement about the evidence that he has against Troy. He never once said his prime witness was the only one who had a .38 caliber weapon that night. His prime witness was the one, you know, he's saying that the recantations might have been paid for. But here it is, the guy that was being attacked was on CBS World News saying, I never saw Troy Davis in the parking lot. I know who I was arguing with. The guy that had the gun was arguing with me, but I never saw him strike me because I turned away from him for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what the prosecutor is doing is he's putting bits and pieces of the truth to put it together to look like, you know, we had this big airtight case on Troy Davis. You know, he even talked about this other shooting where, you know, even though there was no physical evidence linking Troy to any shell casings, here you have witnesses coming forward. The parole board said, we were involved in that shooting. We threw away our shell casings in those areas because we lived there. You know, so what they did was they took the scenario of what Sylvester Coles was doing and they put it on Troy. And, you know, for years, people were saying, well, okay, the police officer got shot over a can of beer and Troy was fighting. Troy was not fighting over the can of beer. He was not in the altercation with Larry Young. So my thing is that the prosecutor has been able to, you know, his career is riddled with prosecutorial misconduct.
Whose career? Are you talking about Spencer Lawton?
Spencer Lawton. Well, I mean, he's had 4 exonerations just under him alone.
Well, Martina, I just have to take a short break here and come right back, mm-hmm. because we have to talk. This is a fundraiser for WEA, a public radio station here in Baltimore at Morgan State University. We're going to come back to Deirdre O'Connor and Martina Correa to talk about this very critical case. An innocent man, another innocent black man, may be put to death in Georgia. The Supreme Court will not overturn the case. America can. We'll come back and talk about that when we return. So stay with us. This is very, we'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm talking right now about the Troy Davis case in Georgia. We are talking with Deirdre O'Connor, professor at the Emory Law School and director of Innocence Matters. Martina Correa is Troy Davis's sister. She's also the National Steering Committee Chair for Amnesty International's USA program to abolish the death penalty and Amnesty International's State Death Penalty Abolitionist Coordinator in Georgia. They join us here. You can join us at 410-319-8888 to join into this conversation or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. This is a case that is in a very desperate stage at the moment because this time next week, Troy Davis may be put to death for a crime that, even if you believe in the death penalty, for a crime that we do not know if he really committed and will not know the truth unless he's granted a new trial, and that's not happening. And I'm so shocked here in a couple of ways. Let me turn first to Martina and then to Deirdre. And by the way, can you two hear each other now?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes.
That's good. Good. So, Martina, let me start with you, then I'll go to Deirdre. I want our listeners to kind of get it, put our hands around how this could be happening. How could it be possible that the majority of witnesses, I think 7 out of 9, if I'm right, of the witnesses have recanted their testimony, no gun was ever found. There's real question about whether or not your brother, Troy Davis, is guilty, yet he could be put to death, and nobody's granting a new trial. What can be done at this stage, Martina? Then we'll go to Deirdre.
Well, I know what we're doing is we're fighting with every, you know, fiber of our being. I mean, the lawyers are still filing things in various courts. We are challenging the Georgia Parole Board that can still give clemency. The problem with the Parole Board is the Parole Board is made up of police officers and prosecutors. So when you're dealing with a prosecutorial and police misconduct case, they're not willing to overturn it. And the Parole Board in Georgia acts in secrecy. There's no transcripts, no recordings, no anything. So one side does not know what the other side is doing. So the victim's family never even heard the witnesses in their own words recant. And it's amazing to me, you know, the governor of Georgia can have some sway on the Parole Board because they're appointed by the governor. But, you know, Georgia has been a pivotal part of the death penalty debate, the Furman and the Gregg case, and various other things. Georgia came out, the American Bar Association came out with a report about the death penalty and its application in the South. Georgia was the first state that they investigated, and we failed ridiculously. But the thing about it is Georgia wants to remain defiant. That's why they deny the death row inmates access to the press, the media. No one can talk to them. And, you know, it's amazing. We have a doctor, Dr. Musso, in Atlanta, who's being paid $18,000 per execution to participate. And so we're attacking from all fronts. I mean, this case, if Troy is executed, Georgia, you know, make no mistake, they're going to dismantle the death penalty system in that state because people are outraged all over the world. And it's just truly disgusting that we use legal technicalities that can hinder people. If Troy was rich and white, he wouldn't be there. If Troy was not a black, or if this was not a black on white crime, I don't think it would be a death penalty case. You know, and unfortunately, I've not tried to make this case about race, but, you know, it's like the Obama situation. It's raising its ugly head, and you see it for what it is, because how can you put someone to death and talk about why they didn't do this legal procedure and why they didn't do that? He didn't have any control over that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're willing to put him to death based on work that other people are doing or have not done. You know that there was ineffective assistance of counsel because there's no money to defend death row inmates in Georgia, but you're still willing to kill people. And it's like that strange fruit Billie Holiday was talking about, you know, hanging from the trees, but it's in the justice system. And so, you know, I'm truly disgusted because one of the things about these witnesses is when we went before the parole board, I mean, they badgered them. One of the parole board members, you know, insinuated that all black men carry guns and are gun-toting thugs. You know, come on. You know, you're homeboys. And he's a black minister that's also a DEA agent. But that's what he was telling the witnesses.
Well, Deirdre O'Connor, I mean, I'm listening to what Martina Correa is saying here. And it, I mean, and I've been trying to read through as much of your brief as I could in the last couple days and read the recantations of the witnesses. And read what you wrote in your conclusion. I just legally, I mean, how could this happen? I mean, how could the possibility that how could an innocent man be put to death, or somebody who may be put to death, without anybody in the legal system saying no? I mean, I'm just a little shocked by that they will not give him a new trial on the basis of the new evidence.
Well, you're right. And unfortunately, you shouldn't be shocked because it's happening all throughout our country. What we know now with the 222 DNA exonerations is that the innocent, once convicted, have an extraordinarily difficult time getting their evidence of innocence heard. And I really want to spend a moment talking about the reliability of the original trial testimony here. But if you look at Professor Brandon Garrett's article, Judging Innocence, it chronicles the struggles for many of the 222 DNA exonerations. They had to fight tooth and nail to get the DNA evidence, and prosecutors were resisting it. And the courts were very ineffective at dealing with claims of actual innocence. And so you'll see people incarcerated for decades who are factually innocent of the crime, and there is, we don't have in our system an effective way to deal with that problem, and we know it to be a problem that's no longer subject to dispute. In this particular case, what hasn't happened and what needs to happen is an examination of the reliability of the original evidence offered at trial. You've already mentioned there was no physical evidence tying Mr. Davis to this crime. What was used to convict him was a group of eyewitness identifications, which eyewitnesses on a good day can be problematic, right? A well-intentioned, honest person can make a mistake. But these witnesses were subjected to so much more than that, and they were vulnerable to these police pressures. But if you just look at the circumstances, you can see that what they reported initially was entirely implausible and unreliable.
I'm sorry, DJ. Finish what you're saying. I apologize.
Well,
go ahead.
Dorothy Farrell, for instance, she was standing 160 feet away looking into a dimly lit parking lot at four male strangers, all of the same race, and from that distance, completely indistinguishable. There is no way she could see the face of the shooter or any of those men in the parking lot that night to allow her to make an identification some 10 days later.
We can ask you a quick question, Deidre, about that, and then we'll turn back to Martina and get to some callers in here before we have to end the hour. That when Spencer Lawton writes in his response to the denial to certiorari in the Supreme Court in Davis versus Georgia, he wrote in here that the law is skeptical of post-trial newly discovered evidence, A, and in kind of accusing the defense of having these recantations of 7 to 9 witnesses obtained by coercive tactics. I mean, accusing the defense of using coercive tactics.
I know, that's quite interesting considering what each of the witnesses are saying. When these witnesses were at trial and they were giving their closing argument, the prosecution was giving their closing argument, they went to great pains to emphasize the fact that these were independent witnesses, independent from one another and independent from Mr. Davis. In other words, they had no reason to harm him. They had they were doing what a good citizen would do. And now that he no longer needs these witnesses and they're not saying something that helps him maintain his conviction, suddenly these witnesses are easily manipulated by defense lawyers, despite the fact that there's not a single shred of evidence that there's been any manipulation, pressure, coercion, guilt, or anything imposed upon these witnesses. These witnesses have been struggling with their conscience for all these years and have been worried about being charged with perjury for coming forward and telling. He ended up getting the courage to tell the story. But you have one witness after another who is completely unreliable. A man was at the scene, could not identify the shooter that night or months later, well after Mr. Davis's arrest. And he comes into court 2 years later and says, that's the man, definitely sure of it. I mean, that's ridiculous, and yet that's what this conviction is based on. And until we get the courts to look at the underlying evidence offered in this case, Mr. Davis is not going to receive justice.
So we have to leave in about 2 minutes. So I wonder, Martina, if you could tell us, and try to get a phone call in here, if you could tell us what people who are listening to this program can do now. I mean, what can people do at this late hour to defend your brother from being put to death?
Well, first I would tell them to go to the TroyAnthonyDavis.org if they want to get more information about the case. They can see timeline and just straight information about the case, TroyAnthonyDavis.org. They can also go to www.gfadp.org. That's Jordan's for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. And they can see all the actions that we're doing, letters to the doctor, letters to the parole board, letters to the governor. We need people calling, faxing the governor, the parole board, and demanding that they give Troy clemency, at least until we can get a new trial, but at least save his life. We need all legislatures, people from all over the country, people who are medical people to call in. If people know people in the Georgia area, we're having a big rally on this Thursday, the 23rd, at the state capitol from 6 to 8 p.m. So get involved, but do something.
Martina, I wish we had more time. Martina Correa and Deidre O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us. Let me see. You can go to steinershow.org. We'll put all the contact information on there so you can see what you, so you can raise your voice about this case. Good luck, and God bless you both. And I hope that we can save your brother's life.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Soiree Catering, we want to thank Soiree Catering and Event Planning for providing dinner for our volunteers tonight. Soiree specializes in urban chic cuisine. For more information, you can call 410-366-5455. And I want to say that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And you can call right now at 410-319-8888 or log on to WEAA.org to pledge your support for WEAA and The Mark Steiner Show, which is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered and directed by Zachary Coleman. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Queen Cuts. To hear this show again and to podcast any of our past shows and additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.